Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Everyday Black History. Happy Monday. I hope you're having a great start to your week so far. Well, it's February 10th, and it's like, man, you know, the month is going by pretty quickly. We're already in February in 2020. We're already in February 10th in 2020, and, you know, I mean, this month is flying by, and time flies by, and Black History Month always flies by, and even though But that's why we call it Everyday Black History, because we cover Black History on every day, not just during the month of February. But it always amazes me how quickly, you know, the month of February just goes by. Before you know it, it'll be March. But anyway, we're not going to, you know, look that far ahead. Right now, we're going to deal in the now. And on this February 10th, this Monday evening, we'll be highlighting two women who contributed majorly to Black history. And whether they are well known or not, or whether their contributions famous contributions or considered bigger contributions or smaller contributions, they still contributed to Black history. They still proved to be an inspiration by the way they lived their lives and the things that they accomplished. So we're going to highlight two women. The first woman that we're going to talk about is a woman by the name of Anna Johnson Dupree. And Anna Johnson Dupree was a businesswoman and a philanthropist. Now, she was born in 1891, November 27th. And she was born she grew up in a family that picked cotton for a living, you know. And she was born in Carthage. And she was the great-grandchild of a slaveholder and the grandchild of former slaves. So she heard stories about slavery all her life growing up from her grandparents and how it was for them. And, of course, it's going to have a deep effect on you, because being born in 1891, you were, you know, close to slavery, and you were still feeling the effects of Jim Crow and all that, you know, really, really in a real strong way, especially in the South. So, you know, they grew up poor. You know, her and her family grew up poor. It was her and five siblings and her parents in a two-room house. And despite their, meager, living situation, her grandmother, her mother, they never permitted her to complain about, you know, their station in life, because as she always reminded her, there was always other children who were worse off than this. And that's sometimes what we all have to remember, just dealing in our everyday life. You know, when we're going through problems, it's like there's always someone who has it worse. And it's in those moments where you can sometimes, you know, count your blessings and think about what you do have. They were a tight-knit family. And it was, you know, just hearing those stories that actually influenced her to strive for a better life, you know, for herself. And it had a profound effect on her, as we, you know, mentioned. Now, as a young woman in 1904, she moved to Galveston, Texas, where she earned a living as a domestic worker, which was popular at the time. And she was noted for her sewing skills. And she was hired to work in Houston in 1911, you know, sewing, making dresses. And she would return home to see her family often, you know, from time to time. But she met her husband, Clarence Dupree. He was from Louisiana. She met him in Galveston, where her family was. And she referred to him as a very unusual purpose. It's not said why she called him unusual, but she liked him enough to marry him in 1914. And they moved to Houston, Texas in 1916. And the thing about them is that, you know, they're you know, what we would consider a power couple now. Not in the sense of, like, you know, they were a famous, well-known power couple, but they were a power couple in the sense where they, you know, were successful together. They did their successes together. And the thing that I like about them that is inspirational is that, you know, they didn't invent anything. They weren't scientists. They weren't in the medical field. They just, you know, built up what they had just by saving up their money and living simply. They saved their money, and then they began to invest in what they could into real estate. And little by little, you know, they, you know, bought properties around them, and they were able to kind of, you know, they were able to build up their fortune, and they did it together. You know, she worked in as a domestic worker, and she also began to work in a beauty salon in a white neighborhood, and you know, he worked as well. And as mentioned, they just saved their money, invested in real estate. And during World War One, Clarence Dupree was sent overseas to fight. And even while he was over there, whatever money he got while he was in the military, he saved it. And when he returned to the United States after the war, he had a good amount of money that he had saved. And she, while he was away, was continuing to work and save her money as well, continuing to invest in real estate. And she worked as a beautician and a manicurist. And, you know, she began to make house calls to customers that worked in a beauty salon. And she was doing so well with her house calls that she was able to quit working at the beauty salon and run her own thing. Now, she was so successful in making these house calls that there was a group of white beauticians in Houston that banded together to stop her. That's how well she was doing. She was taking all their customers because of her good work. Now, she decided after that happened to stop making house calls, but that she vowed that she would create her own shop. And she didn't just create her own shop. I mean, she built her own beauty salon. And in this beauty salon, it had a Turkish bath, a sweat box, and a massage parlor in 1936. Now, in 1936, the country was going through the Depression. One of the worst economical, you know, periods in American history. And here it is, she built this business during the Depression. She was able to make a living during the Depression. And you know, that's one thing, a lot of the successful entrepreneurs that we've covered, black entrepreneurs that we've covered, a lot of them built their businesses during this time, during the Depression. And while so many people in the country were starving, including, you know, black people, but so many people were starving and rich people were losing their fortunes, there were still innovative black men and women who were building their fortunes and building their companies during the Great Depression. And, you know, she was one of them. Together, the couple invested in other business and they opened in other businesses, and they opened up the El Dorado Ballroom in the Third Ward. And it was built in 1939. It was one of the first black clubs and entertainment venues in Houston. They also opened the Pastime Theater before that in 1929. So they, you know, already were starting to build up their businesses and expanding their portfolio outside of just investing in real estate, how they started in the early 1900s. They opened up a pharmacy, a men's apparel store, and a paint store, as well as a nightclub to go along with the El Dorado Ballroom and a Pastime Theater. So they built up a small empire in Houston together, you know, during this time. And by 1944, they were doing so well and so wealthy together that when there was construction for a building for underprivileged black children that was being built, the Duprees startled not only the community, but also the United States as a whole with a gift of $20,000, which is equivalent to over $283,000 in 2018 money. So imagine that they were doing that well, that they were able to make a donation to this school so that to help it so that it can continue to be built at that size. And as I said, you know, they startled the whole country. Not startled, but surprised the whole country that they were doing that well, that they were able to make a donation so big. And it was considered one of the largest gifts that was ever given by a Southern black person at the time. You know, so the place was named the Anna Dupree College, or Cottage, of the Negro Child Center. And it was located in the Fifth Ward. By 1952, the Duprees opened the Eliza Johnson Home for Aged Negroes, and it was named. This home was named in the memory of her mom, and she donated property in Highland Heights for the Eliza Johnson Home, And she would go there regularly, and she'd make fruit cobblers and fruit and boiled dumplings for the old-timers that were there, you know, to keep the spirits up. They also continued to give. They gave money to the Houston College of Negroes, which is now the Texas Southern University, and the United Negro College Fund. They gave $11,000 in 1946 to the Houston College of Negroes so that the college could construct its first permanent building. And they also raised money for Camp Robin Hood, which was the first black Girl Scout camp. And they sponsored the first Little League baseball team for black children in Houston. Unfortunately, Clarence Dupree died in 1959. And throughout the years that followed Anna, her health declined, and she eventually moved into the Eliza Johnson home. She died there on February 19th, 1977, and her body was donated to medical research. But as I mentioned, you know, they're a power couple who did it together. They built their empire together, and they did it simply just by, you know, living simply, saving money, and investing in the real estate around them. To back then, real estate wasn't as expensive as it is now. Maybe, you know, living in cities that is, you know, hard to buy because property is so expensive. But, you know, they lived simply. They started out building real estate, and look what it led to. You know, a theater, a ballroom, apparel store, pharmacy, paint store, nightclub. They were able to do all this together, you know, just by, you know, working hard, living simply. And that's why I said it's amazing how they did it. And they really are an inspiration to all, you know, just regular folks out there, you know, because of how they built their fortune. Like I said, they weren't inventors. They weren't, you know, scientists or anything like that. They just did it by just working hard and living simply. So Anna Johnson Dupree, and we thank you for your contribution to black history and black culture, and what you contributed to it. Now, the next woman who we're going to highlight today is a woman by the name of Jane Cook Wright. And Jane Cook Wright was a pioneering cancer researcher and surgeon who was noted for her contributions to chemotherapy. She is credited with developing the technique of using human tissue culture rather than laboratory mice to test the effects of potential drugs on cancer cells. She also pioneered the use of the drug methotrexate. I hope I'm saying that right. But she pioneered the use of that drug to treat breast cancer and skin cancer. And she made huge strides in cancer research and how, you know, cancer research and the treatment of cancer is done today. Now, Jane Cook was born November 20th in 1919. And she was born in the city of Manhattan, New York. And she comes from a medical family. Her mom, Corinne Cook, was a public school teacher. But her dad, Lewis T. Wright, came from a medical family. I mean, and, you know, the men on her dad's side, you know, they themselves are an example in black history. I mean, Jane's grandfather was born into slavery, and after the Civil War earned his medical degree at Meharry Medical College. And her grandfather's father was also the first African-American to graduate from Yale Medical School. And as mentioned, her father, Lewis T. Wright, was a great inspiration to her, and he was among the first black students to earn a medical degree from Harvard Medical School, and the first African-American doctor at a public hospital in New York City, where he worked at Harlem Hospital for 30 years, founding and directing the Harlem Hospital Cancer Research Foundation. So her father, her grandfather, her great-great-grandfather, they all were in the medical field. And as mentioned, they are themselves examples of black history by being the first to make accomplishments, graduating from Yale, Harvard, you know, getting a medical degree after the Civil War. You know, so she had, you know, this in her blood. But interestingly enough, you know, as a child, she went to the Ethical Culture School and the Filston School when she graduated in there in 1938. And interestingly enough, when she went to college, she went to Smith College. She went there originally wanting to pursue a degree in art. you know, but her father suggested that she change her studies to pre-med, in which she did, and she graduated from Smith College with an art degree in 1942. But she, after her studies there, she earned a full scholarship to study medicine at New York Medical College, and she was part of an accelerated three-year program, but she graduated at the top of her class, you know, with honors in 1945. And after graduating from there, she earned an internship at Bellevue Hospital during 1945 and 1946. And during all this, she even found the time to get married and have a family. She got married to an attorney, David Jones, in 1949. And they had two children together. They had two children together, two daughters. So, you know, and she completed her residency. At the Harlem Hospital in 1948, excuse me, where her father was. Now, while she was at Harlem Hospital, as we mentioned, she did a residency at Bellevue Harlem Hospital, and she completed her tenure at Harlem Hospital as chief resident. Then she joined her father and at the Harlem Hospital Cancer Research Center, and she succeeded him as the director when he died in 1952. And in the mid-50s, in 1955, she accepted a research appointment at NYU, Bellevue Medical Center, as an associate professor of surgical research and the director of cancer research, which started her career in making huge discoveries. But the way she got onto that path is while she was at the Harlem Hospital Cancer Research Center with her dad, they wanted to make chemotherapy more readily accessible for everyone. At this time in the 1940s and 1949, chemotherapy was a new development, so it wasn't well known or wasn't a well practiced source for treatment, and it was like still in the experimental stage of drug development. It was considered like a last resort. And the drugs that were available and the dosage weren't very well refined, so you know, it wasn't a method that hospitals use during this time when someone had cancer. I mean, basically back in those days, a cancer diagnosis was pretty much fatal. But Jane and her father wanted to make Jane and Dr. Lewis T. Wright, her dad, wanted to make chemotherapy more accessible for everyone and an accessible method of cancer treatment. So they were able to discover new agents that could be used for cancer treatment. Now, her work involved studying the effects of various drugs on tumors. And as we said before, she was the first to identify methotrexate as one of the foundational chemotherapy drugs as an effective tool against cancerous tumors. Her early work brought chemotherapy out of the realm of the untested and as a experimental hypothetical treatment into the realm of the tested, proven effective cancer therapeutics. And by her doing this research and conducting this research and making these drugs more readily available, she saved millions of lives. So then, during this time, getting a cancer diagnosis wasn't as fatal as it was prior to her research and her discoveries. She pioneered what's called combinatorial work in chemotherapeutics, which focused not simply on administering multiple drugs, but sequential and dosage variations to increase the effectiveness of chemotherapy and minimize side effects. You know, chemotherapy does have a lot of drastic side effects for the patient, and sometimes doctors will just ply you with radiation to shrink a tumor. But through her research, she was able to find different dosages so that maybe it wouldn't have as harsh a side effect on the patient. And she was successful in identifying treatments for both breast and skin cancer developing a chemotherapy protocol that increased skin cancer patient lifespans for up to 10 years. She also developed a non-surgical method which used a catheter system to deliver potent drugs to tumors located deep within the body, such as the liver or the spleen. She published more than 100 papers on cancer therapeutics during her career and served on the editorial board of the Journal of the National Medical Association. And the thing that that's also appreciative is that she collaborated with another a Black American woman scientist by the name of Jewel Plummer Cobb. They collaborated often on their work. Jewel Plummer Cobb was a cell biologist, so they, you know, no doubt collaborated a lot in their respective fields. And it was a source of camaraderie, you know, two Black women in a white male dominated field to make these discoveries that they did. We'll talk more about Jewel Plummer Cobb, you know, soon on another episode, because she made some groundbreaking discoveries as well. Now, Jane Wright, she was also very active professionally. You know, she was the only woman among seven physicians who helped to found the American Society of Clinical Oncology in 1964. She was the first woman elected president of the New York Cancer Society in 1971. She was appointed the associate dean and head of the cancer chemotherapy department at New York Medical College in 1967. And that made her the highest ranked African-American physician at a prominent medical college at the time. She was also appointed to the National Cancer Advisory Board by the President Lyndon Johnson, serving from 1966 to 1970, and the President's Commission on Heart Disease, Cancer, and Stroke. She was also internationally active, leading delegations of oncologists in China, the Soviet Union, countries in Africa, and Eastern Europe. She worked in Ghana in 1957 and in Kenya in 1961, treating cancer patients. And from 1973 to 1984, she served as the vice president of the African Research and Medical Foundation. She received many awards, including the Honorary Doctorate of Medical Sciences degree from the Women Medical College of Pennsylvania. And she retired from all this work and all these accomplishments in 1985, but she was still appointed a professor at New York Medical College in 1987. You know, when she talked about her pioneering research in chemotherapy, she told a reporter, "There's lots of fun in exploring the unknown. There's no greater thrill than in having an experiment turn out in such a way that you make a positive contribution." So, there's, you know, she wrote, you know, many papers, as mentioned, over 100 papers, won many awards and recognitions. But her work, you know, her work and what she's accomplished, you know, has saved millions of lives, her work in cancer research and breast and skin cancer. And we just wanted to honor her today on Everyday Black History for her work and for what she's accomplished, because this is one of those major accomplishments. You know, like we said earlier, there's some people in Black history who make accomplishments in business, and, you know, like Annie Dupree, who, you know, she might not have been a scientist, but she's an inspiration, you know, to, you know, the average person, where they can start and build their own successful, you know, mini empire where they live. And then there's accomplishments like Jane Wright, who, you know, literally saved millions of lives in cancer research and comes from this family of medical doctors, and which is in her blood. And that's just, you know, how the saying goes, Black people aren't a monolith. These are examples to show just how, you know, the range that we have and our accomplishments as Black people as a whole, all of us, you know, whether it's science like Jane Wright or just in business like Annie Dupree. So we just want to highlight these two women today on Everyday Black History, on their accomplishments for Black History Month. And that concludes this episode. And we'll be coming again with more history. As mentioned, we'll do an episode on Dr. Jewel Cobb, Jewel Plummer Cobb, and her accomplishments. And we'll just have plenty more to talk about him here on our next episode. So everyone have a good night, and just stay tuned for the next episode.